From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. Health officials in Los Angeles County are warning of a coming shortage of ICU beds. A stay-at-home order remains in effect in L.A. to fight the latest surge in coronavirus cases there.
Well, in the Dallas area, that shortage is already a reality. Barclay Burdan was among the first to sound the alarm there. He's CEO of Texas Health Resources, the region's largest healthcare system. Mr. Burdan, Barclay, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. It's good to be with you.
Well, but a tough time, and it's been a week since you made that prediction about running out of space in ICUs. Now it's happening. I'm sure you'd rather not have been right, but tell us, what does this mean? What happens? Are elective surgeries going to be canceled? Will 911 dispatchers be instructed not to bring people to ICUs? What's going on?
Yes. Well, we have what we call surge plans, and we begin to reallocate the resources that we have. So, for instance, people I think are familiar with the concept of the recovery rooms after surgery. Those are places that are basically like an ICU. And so we begin to not do surgeries, and some surgeries we can postpone that are not urgent. And that begins to free up some of those recovery room areas where the staff are basically like ICU nurses. They're critically care trained. And we begin to manage patients in those areas. Those are how we begin to reallocate resources. So we can surge up from our standard bed complement and add another 100 beds relatively quickly. And that's what we will do if we're at that point. Our analytics right now would tell me that our ICUs, we didn't peak out in the ICUs over the week, but we're continuing to grow. And it looks like right now about the beginning of next week is when we think ICUs may hit their physical capacity, and we may have to begin to implement some of those strategies.
And we know that many of your healthcare workers are living in hotels, away from their families, to keep their families safe for months. And you've spoken rather plaintively about the sacrifices that these healthcare workers have already made, living in hotels. What's going on there?
Well, for now going into our 10th month, we have had the heroes that staff all of our patient-facing areas, ICUs, med-surg, ERs, that have been caring for these patients. And they see the devastating impact that this has on individuals and families and on our community. They also recognize, I think, that it's important that our communities continue to operate. And so they're asking, why won't more people take the simple precautions of wearing a mask, staying out of crowds, washing your hands more frequently? Because, in fact, we think that we don't have to have everybody doing that, but if we have more people doing that, that it will tamp down the growth of the infection.
And meantime, you mentioned, the hope on the part of healthcare workers that people would help here. And a study from the University of Texas Southwestern showed that you're right. Even if the rate of wearing masks or social distancing ticked up just a little bit, 11%. Just a few percent. It would not only flatten this curve you're seeing, but it would send it downward. And we're also hearing that this rate of hospitalization is triggering a shutdown of some businesses today because of the rate of hospitalizations. So some bars will be closed, gyms, restaurants will be at half capacity. So, tell us more about the message you want to get out. People have a part to play in not only making sure there's a hospital bed for their loved one, but that their businesses can stay open if they just wear the masks.
Well, I think that's the point, is that we want our communities to be healthy. We want our economy to be to return to health. And if we want to keep businesses open, the way to do it is to protect everybody. And that's clearly what the nurses, the doctors, the respiratory therapists in my hospital see, and why they're pleading with people and are asking me, how can we get more people to take the preventive measures so that we can tamp down the growth of this and get it back under control and not have to close down businesses in our community.
Yeah. Barclay Burdan, CEO of Texas Health Resources. Thanks, and best of luck to you there.
Thank you so much.
Well, as we just heard, parts of Texas are on the verge of reinstating restrictions on businesses as the pandemic worsens, and the economic impact of the virus has been particularly bad in cities that cater to tourists and business travelers, including San Antonio. Texas Public Radio's Paul Flav has more.
The lobby of San Antonio's Henry B. Gonzalez Convention Center has been empty most of this year. The 1.6 million square foot facility is an engine of economic activity for the city, and usually sounds like this. That's during a 2017 technology conference. But now the center sounds like this. It's a lot different than how Visit San Antonio CEO Cassandra Mate found the city 9 years ago when she interviewed for the job.
I remember on a Tuesday sitting on the Riverwalk going, look at all the people.
When people visit San Antonio, it's often because of a convention. And the thing they remember is often this.
And the world-famous 15-mile-long Riverwalk.
The 2 miles of it crammed with bars and restaurants is the destination for weary conventioneers and tourists pouring out of nearby hotels after a long day of networking or searching for the Alamo. Revelers float by on water taxi tours as people walk below the boughs of trees lining the river trail.
In the summertime, we are the leisure travel destination for the state of Texas. On an annual basis, we welcome around 39 million people to San Antonio, of which a big portion of that is conventions and meetings.
Those were the days. More than 220 meetings and conventions were canceled this year, losing the city millions of visitors.
You know, sometimes I think people forget about that domino effect. Those same people staying in hotels are going to restaurants, are going shopping, are going to our museums. They're paying sales tax, which go into our general funds of our city, so impact the streets, safety, etc.
San Antonio's already slashed its budget, estimating a $60 million drop from hotel taxes and cutting or delaying $50 million in road projects. Cities like San Antonio, New Orleans, Charleston, and others that rely on travelers are getting hammered, says Brookings Institution's Alan Berube, leading to
a higher unemployment rate, higher share of small businesses remaining closed, higher share of folks needing emergency assistance, higher rates of evictions or people near eviction.
In San Antonio, where 1 in 7 people work in hospitality and leisure, the unemployment rate, at nearly 8% in September, was 5 points higher than February.
Wait.
The bare streets outside the convention center downtown tell the story. Hotels are still half empty 8 months later. Many reduced staff dramatically, and a survey by the American Hotel and Lodging Association, or AHLA, found 3/4 expected additional layoffs. Mary Saucedo used to work at the Grand Hyatt as a maid.
I'm like really behind on my rent. I'm already going on my 3rd month that I haven't paid them. And with the landlord, she's good about it, but I know I understand she needs her money as well, right? So I'm trying to get some help.
The money from her job and with her husband's as a mechanic allowed them to raise 5 kids, but not anymore. Not only because she lost her job, but because she lost her husband. He got COVID-19 and passed away in July.
It's tough, and it's still tough for me. Like, I was, sometimes when I'm driving, I see him, like, or I see him in the house. I see him at work. I see him.
Saucedo got a temp job at a local hospital, but it pays less than half what she was making. Visit San Antonio's Cassandra Mate estimates it will be 2024 before travels at pre-pandemic levels. AHLA says the country has lost more than 4 million jobs in the industry, and many may not come back. San Antonio is trying to prepare workers for life after hospitality.
Always be on time. Always be on time. Going to an interview, always be on time.
Geronimo Moreno is pumping up his class for job interviews. This IT course is one of 2 paid for by CARES Act money through the local government. Several attendees come from the hospitality industry.
We did reservations, we did cancellations, so we did a little bit of everything.
Trish Johnson worked at a call center in San Antonio for a major hotel chain for 7 years. But in March, the calls stopped, and she and hundreds of her coworkers were eventually laid off. She says the health insurance has run out, and the severance was very little.
We don't have nothing to eat, no money, because unemployment is very, very little. I guess very little. And we need some kind of assistance to help, more assistance to help us with that, because at the end of the day, it's not our fault.
Johnson recently graduated from the course but is still unemployed, and hoping to find work. She lost her grandmother to COVID a few months ago, and she says she needs more government relief, more money to pay bills. She says they've been forgotten.
And the government is sitting up there sliding their feet. It won't give us relief when we really need this relief. And come on, give us the $600. We need it.
The potential rollout of a vaccine has bolstered the hopes of the industry, but the hole in local economies left by the pandemic and the lack of travel will take a long time to recover from. In the meantime, workers are trying to put food on the table. For Here and Now, I'm Paul Flav.
And Paul's story first appeared as part of Texas Public Radio's podcast, The Shakeout, a series that explores the economic cost of COVID. You may not have heard of Luis Gerardo Mendez, though he's a star in Mexico, and he's appeared in films like Charlie's Angels and Murder Mystery. His new film, Half Brothers, opens in theaters tomorrow. Mendez plays Renato, a Mexican aviation executive whose life is upended when he gets word that his dying father wants to see him. The two haven't spoken for decades. His father left the family in Mexico to find work in the U.S. and never returned. So Renato makes the trip to Chicago. And cultures collide. Here's what happens when he hails a ride at the airport.
Where are you from?
From Mexico.
Oh, Mexico.
Yes.
I love that Cancun. The zip lining down there, it's amazing. If I lived in Mexico, I'd zip line every day.
Oh, yeah?
You do a lot of zip lining down there?
No, I don't zip line.
What?
Yeah.
Why do you live in Mexico, then?
Later at the hospital, Renato discovers his father had another son with a woman in the United States, and his father's dying request sends the pair on a wild road trip to Texas. Again, the film is Half Brothers, and Luis Gerardo Mendez joins me now. Welcome. It's good to speak with you.
Hi, Peter. Thanks for nailing my name. It's really rare to hear that in the U.S.
Well, good. I put some practice in. The film is kind of an international twist on a road trip buddy movie with some political commentary mixed in. What drew you to it?
I'm from Mexico City. I've been an actor in Mexico for 20 years. Then I moved to L.A. 5 years ago because I wanted to start exploring those possibilities of working in the U.S., And one of the first meetings I had in L.A. was with Eduardo Cisneros and Jason Schumann, who are also the producers and writers of the film. And we were very intrigued about the relationships between brothers and fathers and sons, but especially about creating some kind of metaphor to speak about the differences between the people in Mexico and the people in the U.S., how in a way we are half brothers and we are not that different.
The two countries.
Exactly. We wanted to explore that possibility. And that's how Half Brothers began.
Well, that's interesting. Your character, Renato, is also a pretty compelling guy. He's an aviation executive, a really successful Mexican businessman, which is actually something that you don't see much represented in American films unless the business is narcotics.
Exactly.
Were you trying to bust some Hollywood stereotypes in this movie?
100%. 100%. We really wanted to portray a different Mexican character in the screen, especially in the Hollywood screen, you know, because the characters I do in Mexico, I play all kind of characters in Mexico. But in Hollywood, it's really rare to see a lead in a film who's a Mexican successful businessman. And we are also that as Mexicans. We are also businessmen. We are also writers and filmmakers, mothers and fathers, you know, so for us, it was really important to create this character who's also very complex and he has a lot of issues and he's a deeply wounded kid, you know? So that's the reason Renato is so angry and that's the reason he's so successful at the same time and he's so bad at relationships with other people.
Yeah, you can see why he's angry. The backstory, as you've kind of laid out here, is that Renato's father had a child with an American woman after he got to the United States. And when Renato comes to see his father on his deathbed, he meets his half-brother, Asher. He is not impressed with Asher because he comes off as sort of a bumbling fool, but also because it's his father's son that he never knew about. Renato is horrified at the idea of taking a road trip with him. And then later, as you see this relationship develop between the two characters, you can sense a change. Asher gets Renato out of a jam, and Renato cannot believe that Asher even bothered to help him. Let's listen to this clip.
I'm actually surprised you come to pick me up.
What are you talking about?
What I'm talking about?
Yeah.
Well, why did you come pick me up?
'Cause, man. We're brothers.
Tell me about this relationship between these two guys. And I'm interested now that you said this is a metaphor for Mexico and the United States in and of itself.
Yeah, well, I think both characters are going to teach so much to the other one, but they have no idea that's going to happen. And that's the reason the father creates this trip, this journey with these two kids to, in a way, mix the best of both brothers and have something special. And about what you said about the metaphor between the U.S. and Mexico, for us, it was really important to... Okay, so here's the thing. I really think that comedy is the result of tragedy plus time. All of these lines you're going to hear in the film about the wall, about all these Mexican stereotypes, those things happened to me or to Eduardo Cisneros, the writer and producer. Like, Oh, are you from Mexico? Oh, Cancun. Oh, drug cartels. And it's like, we really wanted to portray those lines in the film because I really believe that comedy is a great vehicle to speak about these things, because when people are laughing and they have their mouths open, that's the perfect moment to put a spoon of truth in their mouths.
Let's talk more about that. This is a comedy. There's no doubt about it. There's moments when you're going to be laughing out loud, but then there are very heavy moments. And I'm thinking about this time when your character is detained by Border Patrol and you're with other immigrants in the cold cell, the icebox or the freezers, as some immigrants come to call them in real life, actually. And You're in this cell. You don't say anything to the other immigrants who are in there with you. You just look at them. And it's a powerful, heavy moment inside of an otherwise kind of hilarious film. How do you pull that off?
I have no idea. You know, like, we were really concerned. We were like, is this going to work? we have no idea. But what we tried to do is, like, just being very respectful. We're going to speak about immigrants with dignity. Then someone is going to understand something, you know, and my character, as you said, he doesn't need to speak. He just needs to realize that that's happening, that exists. There's people there. That's the reality, you know. So we just need to portray that. We just need to show that on the screen. And that immediately is going to cause something in the audience. And that was the thing we were aiming for.
So do you think that making a comedy that's so closely tied to very controversial issues like that will actually help change people's understanding of them?
Well, I don't know. You know, like, it's a lot to ask for a film to change the way someone sees life. But I really believe we can create conversations. Just to have, I don't know, I just have this idea of an American family having a conversation about this scene in Christmas, you know? I think that's really relevant and important right now.
I see that you have a half brother and a half sister. Is that right?
Yes.
Did you tap into those relationships when playing this character, Renato?
Yeah. I mean, I found out I had a half sister like 7 years ago. My father told me that she actually lives in the U.S. So in that moment, I was like, I'm not interested in this. I have no time for this. I'm really focused on my job. I have enough problems to also dealing with a half sister that I never knew about. But then, as we started developing the film, and like I was starting to understand this character, I had like the necessity and the urgency to talk to her. So I called her, and it was really special. It was really interesting because, I mean, of course, it helped me for making a better film and to understand better this character. But I think it also made me a better person, you know, a better human being, a healthier person, because I heard her perspective of the thing that happened. I just heard my father's point of view. So when I had her information, I could see better the whole picture. And in a way, I understood better my father. And by the way, I understood better myself.
You know, I will tell you, I recently had the exact same news dropped on me about a year and a half, 2 years ago. It is a thing that will add some emotional complexity to your life. And that comes out in this film. Yeah. Let's talk about representation. Recently, there's been a lot of talk in Hollywood about bringing a more accurate representation of the world onto the screen. We see that in this film. What are your thoughts?
One character in one film is not enough. You know, like, I really believe it's not a matter of having a percentage of the cast in the film. I think the representation for me is to tell our stories, you know, like to tell stories that matter to us. And for me, it's about seeing myself represented in the screen the way I want to see myself represented in the screen. But I realized doing this film that is us, the Mexican storytellers, the Hispanic filmmakers, we need to tell those stories. We need to be in charge of telling those stories because those are our stories. That's our inner life. That's our experiences. So we need to fight for those spaces, you know? It's not about having one character in one show. It's about telling the stories that are important for us.
Do you think the situation is getting better?
I think so. I do, yeah. I mean, it's a really complex moment in Hollywood and in the U.S. Like, I've never felt more welcome in a way, but at the same time, I never felt a more hostile environment at the same time because of politics and because of elections and because everything that's happening, not just in the U.S., also in Mexico and in the world.
Well, by the way, you are releasing a film in the middle of a pandemic. Is that tough? I mean, how do you measure whether it's a success or not if people aren't going to the theaters like they used to?
It's horrible, Peter. I cannot explain to you how stressed I am.
All
right
that
now,
work.
Yes. But you know what? I learned earlier in life that when you cannot control something, you need to let go and you need to relax. And honestly, releasing my film in the middle of the pandemic is the least important problem that we have in the world right now. So the way I see it is like, if we can offer some people in the US and Mexico laughs and a good time and a heartfelt comedy at the end of this horrible year, I'm gonna sleep like a baby on December 31st.
Luis Gerardo Mendez, star and executive producer of the new film Half Brothers, thank you so much for speaking with me. It was a pleasure.
Thank you, Peter. Thank you so much.
Half Brothers opens in theaters tomorrow.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from MIT System Design and Management, jointly offered by MIT School of Engineering and the MIT Sloan School of Management. Earn a Master's in Engineering and Management. SDM educates mid-career professionals to solve complex challenges at the intersection of business and technology. With over 20 years of on-campus, hybrid, and distance education experience, join a virtual info session on Thursday, December 10th from 9 to 10 a.m. sdm.mit.edu.
NASDAQ is proposing a new demand for companies listed on the exchange. Make your company's board of directors more diverse and make that information public. Corporate boards are traditionally dominated by white men, and this is a proposal to shake that up. Mike Regan is senior editor for Bloomberg News. Hey, Mike.
Hi, Peter.
And tell us more about what NASDAQ is trying to do here.
Well, Peter, the stated goal of the proposal is to provide investors and others with basically a better understanding of who exactly is on these companies' boards and whether or not listed companies are basically taking the idea of diversity seriously. They also sort of framed it in a manner that I think the investor class will be most interested in, citing research that found diverse boards are actually associated with better financial performance and corporate governance. So presenting it as sort of, Peter, a way for investors to understand why they need to know this information.
There's a stat worth noting here that more than 75% of the 3,000 companies listed on the NASDAQ do not meet the new requirements, which I believe is having at least two people from underrepresented groups on the board. It doesn't seem like that's asking much when often a dozen or more people are on corporate boards. What do you think? Will this be tough to comply with?
So I think actually shaking up the board of directors would be challenging for many companies, but there's a sort of escape hatch built into this proposal, and that is that companies would not be subject to having their stock delisted from the exchange if they would provide a public explanation for the reasons for not meeting the objectives on the board. So it's kind of forcing them to come out and tell investors and the public why they can't meet these requirements. And kind of get it out in the open about why they're unable to.
Well, and we do have some insight there from NASDAQ CEO Adena Friedman, who talked about that requirement that companies be transparent about their diversity. Here she is on CNBC this week. Let's listen.
Disclosure is really the foundation of our markets and our economy. So we rely on companies to make full and accurate disclosures to inform investors so that investors can make their own decisions as to which companies they want to invest in and what they expect of the companies.
Mike, why do you think NASDAQ is threatening to delist a company if they're not transparent about this rather than not meeting the standard in by itself?
So my guess is there's likely a big question about overreach on NASDAQ's part. Remember, stock exchanges are very highly regulated, and the Securities and Exchange Commission will have to approve this measure from NASDAQ. But increasing that transparency is certainly something a stock exchange can demand, basically requiring the companies to provide this information so that investors can make informed decisions. I think one thing about that number, that 75% of companies are not in compliance, I think part of the reason for that is NASDAQ doesn't have all the information. So that number might go down if they learn more about who's on all these boards.
All right. Well, let's keep an eye on this one. Mike Regan, senior editor for Bloomberg News. Thank you very much, as always.
Thank you, Peter.
It's hard to come up with new ways to convey the enormity of this COVID-19 outbreak, but here's one that people are trying. Yesterday, the U.S. recorded its deadliest day yet, more than 3,100 deaths, which is more than Japan has had in the entire pandemic. Well, but now there are vaccines on the horizon, there are treatments, and for now at least there are fewer deaths per infections. So let's take advantage once again of Ashish Jha, Dean of Brown University School of Public Health, to get as many questions as possible answered. Dr. Jha, Ashish, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me back on.
Yeah, and just context, you've agreed with other health officials we're headed into some tough times. As you put it, the summer's not going to bail us out this time as they did in the spring, as the summer did in the spring when it got people outside. We don't have that now. But you've also said you're hopeful. So with that mix, let's have a kind of a lightning round. When do you think the average person, not in a nursing home or a nurse on the front lines, the average person will get the two dose needed of a vaccine?
I think the average person probably can get started late March, early April, and probably finish their second dose about a month after that. So if things go well, late March, early April is what I'm hoping for.
Right. So wear your masks. But we're understanding that even when you get a vaccine, you will still have to wear masks for the foreseeable future. Why?
Well, I think the first set of folks who get it, certainly, because the level of virus in the community will still be high. You know, if I told you that you only have a 10% chance of getting an infection that can kill you, you may still choose to wear a mask. The issue becomes that once we have widespread vaccination, and let's say we get to 75, 80%, the virus will really get into very, very tiny numbers. And then I think in lots of different contexts, we can take our masks off. So mask wearing is not forever. It's really until we get widespread vaccination.
And tell us, the Moderna and the Pfizer vaccines both create a little kind of Trojan horse that gets into cells and it tricks the body into creating immunity. So why should people who've already tested positive or been sick, had COVID-19, presumably have immunity? Why should they get a shot?
Yeah, it's a very good question. And we don't know how long natural immunity lasts. Now, obviously, we don't know how long vaccine-induced immunity lasts, though there's reasons to believe that vaccine-induced immunity is going to last potentially longer. And I think everybody should get vaccinated. You know, if you obviously got COVID and recovered very recently and you want to wait a little bit of time, I think that's pretty reasonable as well. But my general feeling is at this point, everybody should get vaccinated. When is their turn? Mostly because we just don't know how long natural immunity lasts.
Well, can you get COVID-19 from the shots?
Absolutely not. So none of the vaccines that are in late-stage trials in the United States use any version of the virus. There's no coronavirus in these vaccines. Both the Pfizer and the Moderna vaccines just essentially use some bit of the genetic material wrapped in some protein. It's physically impossible to get COVID from these vaccines.
Oh, that's good. There's also an emergency authorization from the FDA for a new coronavirus antibody test that can gauge vaccine effectiveness. I mean, how much did it provide immunity? What is that? What do you think of that?
Yeah, you know, so there is there are going to be a lot of these efforts to try to really make sure that people got a response. The challenge here is it's hard to measure immunity. You can measure antibodies, but antibodies can go up, they can wane. If they wane, doesn't mean that you actually don't have immunity, because there's also another arm of immunity called T cells. So I think how to use tests like that and when to use them, for whom, what they mean, are still things we're going to be sorting out. My expectation is most people who get vaccinated will have meaningful immunity from this virus, from the vaccine.
Right. I want to talk for a minute about treatments, and you'd be forgiven for saying I'd rather not, because you got dragged into that Senate committee hearing on the discredited drug hydroxychloroquine that Senator Ron Johnson attacked you, saying there was some kind of deep state conspiracy that you were involved in to deny Americans this drug that was so touted by President Trump. There is not. But Ashish, early on in the pandemic, we spoke with reputable doctors, this is very early on, who said, yes, we are using it. So to be clear, is it thought it doesn't have the effect that it was said to have of preventing or curing COVID-19?
Yeah, so here's the, how the history of this has played out. Early on in late March, the president started touting hydroxychloroquine based on very little evidence. But there was a theoretical benefit, and most of us thought at that point, well, you know, look, we don't have very many treatments. People are obviously getting very, very sick. And so people started using hydroxychloroquine, and then we started studying it and started subjecting it to clinical trials. And I think that was completely the right thing to do, to try it out and to study it in clinical trials to see if it worked. And the early first set of studies said, okay, didn't really do anything in the inpatient setting when people were pretty sick. Next set of studies said it doesn't help prevent people from getting the disease. If you've been exposed, taking hydroxychloroquine doesn't help. And then there are several studies that show that even just as an outpatient therapy, it doesn't work. So at this point, they're all, you know, it's fine to start trying it, but once you've got the evidence in that it doesn't work, you ought to stop.
Why?
And and there is a small group of folks out there who have been hydroxy boosters who are out there beating the drums on this and saying that the entire medical community is in cahoots to deny Americans hydroxychloroquine. And somehow they got to Senator Johnson and he held a hearing about it.
Yeah, and got to you. Look, let's talk about what does work. Remdesivir, does it shorten the length of an illness?
Yeah, so this is one where it's controversial. One big study from WHO shows that it doesn't. Another good study done at, through NIH shows that it does. My best read of the literature is that given early on, it probably does help shorten the duration of the illness, but you got to give it pretty early.
Okay, and what about the drug cocktail that was given to President Trump and people like Ben Carson? It's still experimental. It's a combination of steroids, remdesivir, and antibodies. They swear it saved their lives. Should it be available to everyone? Does it work?
Yeah, so let's talk about each of those. We talked about remdesivir. Dexamethasone, or the steroid, actually the evidence there is very good from large randomized trials. That's really for people with advanced disease, and very good data that it definitely prevents death, saves lives. So severely ill patients should absolutely get that. The big one for both the president and Ben Carson, Governor Christie, was the antibodies. I've been very optimistic about antibody therapy. It does have to be given early. Now there's an emergency use authorization from the FDA for one of them. I think it's great. The problem with this is that there are just so few doses available that most Americans can't get them. And so we're really rationing it for the sickest people. But the ideal would be that this thing would be widely available and then anybody who got sick from COVID could get it. But we're not there yet.
Well, but we understand that this week Eli Lilly is going to pair with CVS in a pilot program in several cities that will treat patients with an antibody therapy. Your thoughts?
Yeah, I think it's great. And again, I'm pretty enthusiastic about this antibody therapy. I think there is reasonably good evidence that if you give it early in the disease course, it makes a difference. The problem with these pilot programs is that they're small, and we have lots of people getting infected who could benefit, but only a small minority will get it.
Okay. Back to the vaccines. Are you concerned about distribution? We know states are going to rely on doctors' offices, pharmacies, health departments to do the vaccinating. The Kaiser Family Foundation says less than a third of states' plans have come up with the number of health providers to do this. Less than half of states have provided the number of people in priority populations, you know, those in nursing homes and on the front lines of healthcare to start. Concerned?
I am concerned. This is another area where you really need strong federal coordination, where there just has not been the kind of federal leadership that you need. And so we are going to need the federal government working very closely with states to sort all this stuff out. And I'm worried about patchy implementation, where some states are going to be terrific and get it done, and other states are going to struggle. And again, this is why federal government, federal leadership matters so much.
We have a half a minute. What do you want to say to people as we head into this dark season?
What I want to say to people is the next 6 to 8 weeks are going to be the worst weeks of the pandemic, but then the light at the end of the tunnel is getting brighter and brighter. And so what people need to do is hold on, because anybody who gets infected now, that is somebody who could have gotten a vaccine in 2 or 3 months. So do the basic public health stuff. Wear a mask. Avoid getting together with people outside your household. And let's get through this. 2021 will be so much better.
Oh, it's right around the corner. Ashish Jha, Dean of the School of Public Health at Brown University. Dr. Jha, Ashish, thanks as always.
Thank you so much for having me back.
Really big lizards are crossing state lines in the American South. The Argentine black and white tegu first appeared in the Florida Everglades nearly a decade ago. But they're on the march. Tegus have shown up in Alabama and Georgia and as far north as South Carolina. Biologists say tegu lizards could wreak havoc on the environment if their numbers keep growing. Amy Yackel Adams is an ecologist with the U.S. Geological Survey. She's with us now. And Amy, these lizards can grow up to 4 feet long. Tell us more about them.
The Argentine black and white tegu is a lizard that is native to South America, and as you mentioned, are now established in Florida. And we are finding populations in Georgia. This is a tegu that is a very stout tegu. When, you know, they have enough resources, they can get pretty large. Although in Georgia, the ones that we are pulling out there on average are less than 2 feet, and that includes the tail.
2 feet. So, but they can get bigger. And I've actually seen pictures of them next to like a household dog, and they're either the same size or bigger than a dog. So, I mean, they can grow pretty big.
Yes. If they have adequate resources and they're an older tegu, they certainly can get large. They're the largest of the tegu lizards.
And as you say, they're native to South America. So how did they get to first to Florida and then further north?
The pet trade. And we also have people in the U.S. that raise them for the pet trade. And those animals are now being either accidentally or intentionally released into the environment. This summer was really the first summer where we saw multiple states reporting tegu lizard sightings. Hmm.
How many do you think live in the United States now in the wild?
Ooh, I don't have a good guess. I do know that there are many hundreds in Florida. In Georgia, we have 30 documented tegu lizards that we've removed from the wild in Georgia. And I know that in South Carolina, they have removed 8, I believe, this summer. So right now, we're in a situation where we really don't have a good sense for how extensive this is.
Well, I know you've studied the potential for these lizards to expand their numbers beyond that, and then you've warned that the entire southeastern United States could be at risk. How much further could they expand their range in the United States? I mean, at what point does the habitat just not work for them anymore?
Our models indicate basically all of Mexico and all of the southern U.S. portion of the U.S. And of course, that would change as, you know, climatic conditions would change.
Right. So the question is, why does it matter? Other than, you know, scaring the pants off of people who are afraid of reptiles and waking up to them one day on the doorstep, and I don't want to be overdramatic here, but what impact could they have on the environment?
Well, they're omnivores, and so the tegus are very good predators, and they have been documented eating all sorts of prey, from toads to crayfish to beetles to invertebrates. Right now in the state of Georgia, They're very concerned about other species that are protected, such as the gopher tortoise. But they're also worried about just ground nesting birds like quails, wild turkeys. So they do pose quite a risk to native fauna.
We should say not to people, though.
You know, the only thought with tegus and people is just if somebody were to hold a wild tegu, they can bite and they can be aggressive. But I will say they are really good runners. And catching a tegu would only happen if it were a tame tegu.
I see. Well, sometimes people in other parts of the country are encouraged to hunt populations. I'm thinking of like wild pigs in Texas or pythons in Florida. I mean, is that something that would control the problem, or are states doing anything that would help manage the populations?
Right now, what states are doing are encouraging citizens to report any sightings so that state agents can be dispatched to maybe place traps and remove them from the wild in their native range. They are hunted rather heavily for their leather, and they can withstand really substantial harvests and still persist. That is what has a lot of state agencies alarmed, is that there is such population resilience in the face of really substantial removal efforts of this species.
A tenacious lizard. That would probably has some state wildlife departments pretty worried. Amy Yackel Adams, research ecologist with the U.S. Geological Survey, talking to us about invasive tegu lizards in the southeastern United States. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Peter.
Robin, I want those lizards to stay away from my house.
Right, but I have to say we're the only program where you might hear the phrase tenacious lizards. I just...
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And he's in Arizona. I'm Robin Young in Boston. It's Here and Now.